One of the side benefits of teaching in our church is that Bruce gives us a weekend off every now and then. And on these weekends off, we sometimes go up the coast. The most recent weekend off for us, we spent at a place called Shoal Bay. Some of you may not know Shoal Bay as Shoal Bay, but rather as the place down the road from Nelson Bay on that lovely stretch of water called Port Stephens, north of Newcastle. The first thing you notice as you come into Shoal Bay is the mountains. There is a headland. As you come around the corner, there is this whopping great headland. It is so large, it appears as though you can almost reach out and touch it. And this beautiful great headland has left in its wake a series of smaller hills. And so you soon realise that the whole little village of Shoal Bay is sort of bracketed by these hills. There is the headland over there, the water here, and then there is hill, all around the place. They sort of define Shoal Bay. You get the impression that they almost push the place into the water. The point I'm trying to establish, you can't be anywhere in Shoal Bay and not feel the presence of those mountains. They define the place. Saturday morning, we get up and we've decided to spend a very active day exploring this scenic rim of Shoal Bay. Downstairs at the reception desk, young lady there, and I ask her quite sincerely, look, we're very interested in getting out and roaming around on those mountains. Can you show us where the track is, say, this one just over here? There are three or four to choose from. Where's the track to that one? And she sort of blushes and looks a bit puzzled. And I say, oh, you're from Shoal Bay, aren't you? Oh, yes, yeah, I've been here for quite a while. Where's the track? Say, the one just over here. And she gets more puzzled and then blushes and giggles. And finally, she comes out with a classic answer. She says, look, I'd love to help you, but I can't. I'm just a local. And I bite my tongue and I'm thinking to myself, how is it possible to be just a local to 600 feet of earth that dominates your landscape? How is it possible to be just a local to literally an interrupted backyard? These hills are so close and so dominant. Can't help you, I'm just a local. I want to begin tonight by suggesting that we are all like that young lady at Shoal Bay. I won't tell you where we're staying in case people bag it. Where we were staying. We are all like her in the sense of being locals to creation. Not locals to Shoal Bay, but locals to creation in general. That is, we don't see things in our world as they really are. We have blinkers on. We don't see God's creation as we should see it. This is really what Psalm 104 is about this evening. If you haven't turned this up, it's on page 695 of the Old Testament section of the Bibles. And there's also an outline of the sermon in the new sheet. Well, the psalmist states his theme in the first verse. Praise the Lord, O my soul. O Lord my God, you are very great. You are clothed with splendour and majesty. Often these first lines of the psalm sort of give us the right focus. You can see here that in a sense this isn't really a creation psalm. It's a psalm about the greatness and the goodness of God, speaking about the greatness and goodness of God in terms of his creation. So in a sense, in a profound sense, it's not actually a psalm about the creation at all. It's a psalm about the God who made the creation, dressing him up in the attributes of his creation. And that's what he does in verses 2 to 4. This is my first point here, the heavens. He wraps himself in light as with a garment. He stretches out the heavens like a tent and lays the beams of his upper chambers on their waters. He makes the clouds his chariot and rides on the wings of the wind. He makes winds his messengers, flames of fire his servants. The creation is to God what a wardrobe is to us. God is, in the psalmist's mind, he dresses himself up in creation. We fling a coat over our shoulders, he flings light over his shoulders. He takes the things of creation and uses them for his purpose, for his bodily purposes. And so we see that all the elemental forces of the universe are here harnessed for service in God's household. He wraps himself in light. He stretches out the heavens. He makes the clouds his chariot. He rides on the wings of the wind. So God, as it were, drives around in the chariots. The winds support his chariot. They are his messengers. When they're not the coolies for his rickshaw, they carry his messengers, his messages. Lightning itself, fire in the heavens, delivers his telegrams. Point being made, all creation serves his purpose. Psalm 119 has got a great verse when it says, "All things are your servants." There is nothing in all creation that doesn't serve the purpose of the God who made it. Paul focused the thought for us a bit further at the end of Romans 11. He says, "All things are from him, through him, and to him." Nothing in all creation serves any other purpose than the purpose of the Creator God. Very important to get that straight. We are talking here about a big God, not a God of the sun or a God of the sea or a Neptune or a whoever. We are talking about the God of all creation. Creation is his wardrobe. Let's move on to the earth. Things get a bit more specific. Verse 5. He set the earth on its foundations. It can never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. But at your rebuke the waters fled. At the sound of your thunder they took to flight. They flowed over the mountains. They went down into the valleys to the place you assigned for them. You set a boundary they cannot cross. Never again will they cover the earth. First thing here is the power of God. Verse 5. He set the earth on its foundations. It can never be moved. I'm no scientist, but I do know that the modern science has told us very clearly that the earth actually moves continually and moves with some very complex movements. So what does that say about verse 5? He set the earth on its foundations. It can never be moved. First thing we have to remember is not to read the psalm as an astronomy textbook. We don't read the writings of the ancient Hebrews that way. We read them as the poetry of faith, not the data of science. What is he saying here in those words? He set the earth on its foundations. It can never be moved. Is he not saying that the earth is thoroughly established in the purpose of God? So the modern scientific insight actually serves to enhance the purpose of the text. In spite of the fact that our globe is spinning through the cosmos, it is nevertheless true that it can never be moved. It is established in the mind and the preserving power of God. This power of God is not indiscriminate. He's not like a Mad Max who just sort of lashes out everywhere. It is an ordering power. Verses 6 to 9 spell this out when we read about the deep. The waters stood above the mountains, but at your rebuke the waters fled. We'll see in the psalm that there's quite a bit said about the waters. In the Old Testament, indeed right throughout the Bible, the waters are a thorn in Israel's side. Back in the early chapters of the Bible, you'd remember that in the story of Noah, it was through water that life was destroyed. Right? It's always water that gets out of control in creation. In fact, water in the first chapter of the Bible represents the chaos from which creation came. The psalmist reminds us here, the waters take their marching orders from God. The high tides of the world will not be one inch higher than he decides. He's not just powerful, his power orders the creation. Thirdly, we move on to the living things on the earth. Verse 10. He makes springs pour water into the ravines, it flows between the mountains. They give water to all the beasts of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. The birds of the air nest by the waters, they sing among the branches. He waters the mountains from his upper chambers. The earth is satisfied by the fruit of his work. See what's happened to the waters. This dreadful, chaotic agent from which the creation was sort of drawn is now swung round by the goodness of this sovereign God to now serve the creation. And so it is water that God gives for the sustenance of his creatures. This dreadful force, which we'll read about still further, is now used by God to benefit his creatures. In other words, the sting has been taken out of the water. Finally, in verse 14, we come upon man. He makes grass grow for the cattle and plants for man to cultivate, bringing forth food from the earth, wine that gladdens the heart of man, oil to make his face shine, and bread that sustains his heart. And so we see man here at last, like a contented hobbit, sitting there in the midst of this tremendous creative display. If you don't know what a hobbit is, Frodo, Bilbo Baggins, sitting there with a round tummy, shiny cheeks, they also are fairly round and rosy, and a twinkle in his eye. He sits there basking in this created order. He has a full tummy, his face shines with oil, and his heart is gladdened with wine. He has the three, in other words, he has the three typical products of Palestine: wine, oil, and grain. And he has them in abundance. Now, of course, we know that people in our world go without food, but that is not the prime definition of the earth, is it? The earth is essentially the sustainer of life. And that's why Paul, in the passage that Jeff read, that's why Paul reacted the way he did to the pagans at Lystra. These people have heard nothing about the God of Israel. He says, look, you characters, though you've never heard of a synagogue, there was one up the road, though you've never heard of the synagogue, though you've never heard of the God of Israel, you have not been left without witness. God has spoken to you. God has said things to you in the created order. You should have picked up. He says, God did good to you in that he gave you rain from heaven, and he satisfied your hearts with food and gladness, gave you fruitful seasons. They should have picked up things. A good, powerful God. Unfortunately, Paul didn't get any further on that occasion. Let's move on to the moon and the sun, verse 19. The moon and the sun. The moon marks off the seasons, and the sun knows when to go down. You bring darkness, it becomes night, and all the beasts of the forest prowl. The lions roar for their prey and seek their food from God. The sun rises, and they steal away. They return and lie down in their dens. Then man goes out to his work, to his labour until evening. Every good household needs a calendar, and God hasn't forgotten to put a calendar there. So he hangs the calendar in the skies, the moon and the sun. And they dictate, or they determine time, not just on the large scale, the seasons, they determine time on the daily 24-hour scale. He hasn't missed a trick. The moon and the sun, they do their bit for creation. They order, under the guise of God, they order the time in this created sphere. What about the sea? 24-26. How many are your works, O Lord? In wisdom you made them all. The earth is full of your creatures. There is the sea, vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number, living things both large and small. There the ships go to and fro, and the Leviathan, which you formed to frolic there. I'm sure you've picked up that this bloke has a bit of an obsession with water. Not that I personally mind being taken back to the seaside several times throughout the psalm. Why does he keep taking us back to the sea? Well, the sea had very special significance for the ancient Israelite. We have to go back further than the story of Noah in Genesis 7. We have to go back to Genesis 1. Listen carefully as I read the first few verses of the creation account, and listen to the profile of the sea, the waters, the deep is given. I'll just read the first three verses. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. First verse, general statement: in the beginning God created heavens and earth. General, all-inclusive statement. Verse 3, forget about 2 for the moment, verse 3 then begins the series of specific days in which creation is specified. Bit by bit, light, heavens, dry land, vegetables, and we go through. But if we were to read through all of those, you would notice that the deep, the waters, are not said to be created in the specificity of those 6 days. So we have the general statement, in the beginning God created the heavens and earth. Then in verse 2, we find that the deep is already around. And so the specific acts of creation, 1-6, somehow come from this chaotic deep. You see, what's the Bible saying about creation? Not so much that creation is nothingness to somethingness, but that it is chaos to order. And what is most chaotic? It's the deep. The Hebrews weren't great sailors. They would avoid the surf like the plague. And what is the most terrifying thing about the deep? It is this strange monster that's mentioned only about four times in the Old Testament, the Leviathan. Serpent, sort of monstrous alligator or something. So to the ancient Hebrew, the most chaotic of chaotics was the Leviathan that inhabits the deep. The closest you could get to chaos in God's ordered world was to be swimming around with this character, the Leviathan. Now let's come back to the Psalm. What does he say about the Leviathan? There is the sea, vast and spacious, teeming with creatures beyond number, living things both large and small. This is scary. There the ships go to and fro, and the Leviathan, which you formed to frolic there. The great and terrible monster of chaos, the thing whose very existence is a threat to creation. In the psalmist's mind, he is God's pet. He frolics, he sports in God's backyard pool like a tadpole. This is the tremendous, scary creature of those early chapters that the Hebrew would prefer not to think about. The chaos monster is, again, diffused. By this stage, the psalmist is getting fairly worked up. And so he gives us a sort of a summary description of what's going on, of the relationship between the Creator and his creation. Let's have a look at this in verse 27. These all look to you to give them their food at the proper time. When you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they are satisfied with good things. When you hide your face, they are terrified. When you take away their breath, they die and return to the dust. When you send your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the earth. The relationship here is one of absolute dependence. Did you notice in the bit just before this, referring to the lions, that the psalmist interprets the roaring of the lions, another fearful thing in his world, he interprets that as their way of saying grace. They roar, the Lord hands them out their dinner. You see, he can't see anything in all creation that isn't somehow a response to this powerful, ordering God. Even the dreadful lion, even the more dreadful Leviathan. And second, while we're still in this section, the relationship is not just one of absolute dependence, it's one of life itself. In verse 29 here, I'll read it as it's written. Our translators have done a bit of interpreting for us. When you hide your face, they are terrified. When you take away their breath, they die and return to the dust. When you send your breath, they are created, and you renew the face of the earth. You see how they've changed that word breath and put in the capital S and the word spirit. In both Old and New Testaments, the same word is there for breath and spirit. That's how we get the foundation of this New Testament idea that the Spirit of the Lord is the breath of his word. It's rooted in biblical language. So what he's saying here is that as God breathes, creation breathes. If God were to hold his breath, creation would expire, suffocate. God breathes, Spirit of the Lord, creation breathes. In other words, the creation's in a constant relationship of mouth-to-mouth resuscitation with God. You can see how far this is from the idea that the deistic God, who has wound up the world, set it going, and he's gone off on a long holiday beyond Pluto. No, this God is intimately involved with what goes on in his creation. That's not to say that he's in his creation, but the relationship is breath to breath. Before we move any further, there are a few things I wanted to say, summing up the view of creation that we have presented in this psalm. Firstly, two views of creation that it's not. The first one I have on the sheets here is that this is not the locals' view of creation. If this bloke, whoever wrote this, went to Shoal Bay, he would come back able to give us a detailed map of everything at Shoal Bay. He would notice things because he sees things as the creative gift of God. That's why he notices them. In other words, creation doesn't wash over him. He doesn't assume that creation will always be there because it's always been there. He knows that if God stops breathing, creation will expire. His view of the creation is not a local's view. He sees everything. He makes distinctions. But, having said that, have you noticed as we've gone through, he makes distinctions in detail, he doesn't make distinctions in value. He's not like us. If we go to Stronger Park, most people ooh and ah over the koalas and the panda bears, and they get decidedly put out about the snakes and the crocodiles. Not so with the psalmist. He sees everything in the creation as illustrating the good purpose of God. Now, we don't know what his personal preferences are. He sees the rock badgers and the cliffs. He sees even the leviathan and the sea. They are all there, ordered in God's world. So he makes distinctions in detail but not in value, in the good gifts of God. I want to spend a moment here on something that I feel is a major issue for quite a few of us. And that is how we as Christians are to use the good gifts of God and yet somehow discharge our responsibility as Christians, especially in the area of evangelism. Evangelism is often the difficult area. It's a problem that I personally have shared in the early years as a Christian. The error creeps in like this. We know that all good things in creation are given to us by God. 1 Timothy 6, God gives us all things richly to enjoy. And yet we feel this tension as to how we should use these things for evangelism. The form that the issue took for me. I'm converted. I'm training to be a pianist. I must somehow use music for the purpose of evangelism. You're an artist. You write books, you're a poet, you become a Christian, you must somehow use those good gifts for the proclamation of the gospel. Understandable problem, isn't it? Let me suggest the problem comes this way, and that is that we get trapped into thinking that the goodness of God's gifts is somehow endorsed by the purpose to which we put them. But that's not so. You see, God's good gifts to us, all these things in creation are good whether we use them or not. Thank God they are still good even when we've misused them. So the goodness of God's gift, whether it be music, poetry, literature, whatever it happens to be, remains good, and its goodness is not increased by the degree to which we enlisted in the evangelistic task. It is still good, thank God. And so in trying to work this one through, often what we do is we minimise both the goodness of God's gifts and the supreme importance of the evangelistic work. We end up being neither good stewards of his good gifts nor good evangelists. In trying to kill two birds with one stone, we kill neither. We become confused, frustrated Christians somewhere in the middle, in a constant state of tension. Rather than accepting the good gifts of God and then with a free and open heart getting on with what evangelistic work we do. The psalmist makes no distinction in the good gifts of God. We should neither. That's why C.S. Lewis said not long before he died, what we need today is fewer people writing Christian books and more Christians writing books. What we have is too many Christians sort of trying to force their talents under the evangelistic umbrella, thinking that they are serving the cause of evangelism. Whereas in fact the evangelism is usually second or third rate. We would be better off enjoying the good gifts of creation and then with a grateful heart overflowing with thanks, evangelising far more powerfully. The locals' view is out. A second view that's out is the greenies' view. The greenies' view. The greenies' view, I suggest, is the view that creation itself should be worshipped or appreciated. We see that when you go to the zoo, unfortunately, and you see the almost reverent adoration of the panda. Notice in this psalm, nowhere is creation or any creature there worshipped. God is worshipped, not his creation. And so he says in these last few verses that we'll read, verse 31, may the Lord rejoice in his works, and in verse 34, as I rejoice in the Lord. I don't rejoice in the Lord's works, I rejoice in the Lord. The creation is not worshipped, the Creator is. Now, the sophisticated view of this, the religious view of it, is pantheism, where not only is creation lifted to a degree that it shouldn't be, a level that it shouldn't be, but God is somehow infused into the creation. And so we say, we can, as I read someone the other day, we can worship God in the tree, in the leaf, in the twig, in the surf. But see, that's confusing, isn't it? There's a very close relationship between God and his creation, but the relationship is one of dependence, not identity. God is separate from his creation, though intimately involved. And that's why it's such a, at least for us, a disillusioning experience to go and visit these little pandas, because we see them being elevated to a level at which they don't belong. And so you're told everything conceivable about the panda. But the question sort of gnawing at the back of your mind as you line up in the whopping great queue, why should we be preserving these creatures? Nowhere is it said out of gratitude for a good God and for his gift. But the assumption all the way along is we should be preserving them because of who they are, not of who God is. We should make sure that those little chaps eat their bamboo forests and do whatever they have to do out of gratitude for a good and loving creator. Not because we like the colour of their fur, as opposed to the goanna up the road. Let me move on. The final point this evening is to suggest to you what the view of creation is that has been pushed here. It's the redeemed view. It's not the locals' view, it's not the greenies' view, it's the redeemed view. Let me read those final five verses. May the glory of the Lord endure forever. May the Lord rejoice in his works. He looks at the earth and it trembles. He touches the mountains and they smoke. I will sing to the Lord all my life. I will sing praise to my God as long as I live. May my meditation be pleasing to him, as I rejoice in the Lord. But may sinners vanish from the earth, and the wicked be no more. Praise the Lord, O my soul. Praise the Lord. Two things here that we see from these verses and the Psalms as a whole. What is the creation? The creation is the sphere of God's creative genius. That's what the creation is. It's the sphere of God's creative genius. If you look at the Mona Lisa, or some great painting in art history, you see a work that tells you something about its creator. You can tell a lot about Leonardo from that painting. If you gather all their works together, you can tell even more about the artist that created them. But of course, you couldn't say that the artist is the painting, or the artist Shakespeare is his output. No, you discern things about Shakespeare from his output, or about a modern artist from his output. But the artist is not to be identified with what he creates. And so here, as we look through the creation with this psalmist, we find things about God, his goodness, his power, his sovereignty, his ordering power, his care and provision for his world. All these things we can and should discern from creation. We shouldn't make the mistake of the people at Lystra, in other words. The creation is the sphere of God's creative genius. But the creation is also the sphere of God's judgment. Listen to these verses. 32. He looks at the earth and it trembles. He touches the mountains and they smoke. See, why does the psalmist ask that the Lord would rejoice in his creation? Because he knows only too well that he doesn't always do that. There are times when God, as it were, frowns at his creation. He is only to give a piercing look at the world, and his judgment is visited on the world in what we, in a silly way, call natural disasters. And so when 1,000 metres of hillside falls down and wipes out these people in Papua New Guinea, we call that a natural disaster. The psalmist would call that people coming under the gaze of an angry God. We call the floods in Bangladesh a natural disaster. That is God visiting his creation in wrath. We don't have to go to Bangladesh, the floods in our own city. The sphere of God's creative genius is also the sphere of his judgment. The two are there in the psalm. How do we bring them together? Well, we bring them together as we do all things in the knowledge of God in the person of Jesus. Let's return to Mona Lisa for a moment. How does the artist identify with his creation? Well, usually, if he's any good, he'll put his signature in the bottom right-hand corner. Put his signature there to show an identity, an identification with what he's created. How does God identify with his marvellous creative work? He writes his signature in the person of his son in the corner of the world called Palestine. He writes himself into the created order. He weaves himself into the fabric of the creation. He doesn't just put a signature there, he puts himself there. The creator becomes the created 2,000 years ago. He inserts himself into the created sphere. And yet this man God will shine more brightly than it does now. And yet, as we read the end of the psalm, the prayer of the psalmist will come true. There will be no wickedness, no evil. Those things will be a thing of the past. The humble people in New Guinea will no longer be obliterated by the effects of God's righteous anger. The people of Bangladesh will not be swimming for their lives. The girls in our city will not be brutally and shockingly murdered day after day. There will be a new heavens. Psalm 104 will be written in big, big red letters. A new heavens, a new earth in which there's righteousness, in which the people of God are at home. And there's not this dreadful tension in the creation that we sense. In conclusion, I want to say a word to those of you who know you aren't Christians. Why aren't you Christians? I mean, if Christ has opened through his death and resurrection the possibility of a new heavens and new earth in which these youngsters won't be torn apart in these dreadful murders, if that's the way forward, why don't you want to be part of it? Can you see the moral onus is on you? Do you want the world to stay as it is? Surely not. You want to get out of it, don't you? And for those of us who are Christians, where do we move from this psalm? Let me suggest that we should move with tremendous gratitude and thanks to our God, this master artist who has fashioned things so beautifully and so well, and with a heart full of thanksgiving, get on with the work, not of the master artist, but of our Saviour. Let's pray.